Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Was John Brown an American hero willing to sacrifice his life to end the brutality of slavery, or was he a terrorist? A lifelong abolitionist like his father before him, Brown became convinced that acts of violence were justified and indeed necessary to keep slavery from spreading to new states and ultimately to eliminate it altogether. The result of that conviction was not only the disastrous 1859 raid on Harper's Ferry, but also the bloody Kansas campaigns of 1856 designed to keep the territory from entering the Union as a slave state. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tony Horwitz tells the story of this deeply divisive figure and of what he represented to his supporters and to his enemies in his book Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. It's out now in paperback. Tony, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So we're still not sure, 150 years later, what to do with the legacy of John Brown. Did you feel the need to resolve that question for yourself in this process, or was it more important to you to leave it open?
I think I wanted to leave it open, and that was actually one reason I wanted to write this book. Quite a bit has been written about John Brown over the years, but I found in reading it that almost everyone who wrote about him, this man just drives people bonkers, even distinguished historians, and they end up either sort of wanting to be there with him charging into Harper's Ferry, or up there on the gallows fitting the noose around his neck. There didn't seem to be any middle ground on this man. And I really wanted to write about him in all his complexity and not tell the reader what to think. And I hope part of the suspense of reading it is figuring out how you feel about this very troubling and complicated man.
So let's talk about his early years. He was raised in this strict Calvinist environment, which left him, among other things, an abiding sense that human nature is quite depraved.
Yeah, he's really almost like the Puritans of the 17th century. He was a bit of a throwback, perhaps, in his religious beliefs. And part of that Calvinist worldview is that humans are really born into depravity, that you have to be constantly vigilant of sin in yourself and in others, and you need to root it out. That's in part what leads him to his war on slavery, which is, of course, the great collective sin of that era. But I think part of that grows from his very strong Calvinist morality.
So he never got over the death of his mother when he was 8, and yet his first memory of her was being beaten.
Yeah, he had, by our standards, I think, a very strict and tough childhood and really a tragic personal life. He loses his mother at 8. He loses several of his siblings. He loses his first wife in childbirth. And he ultimately fathers 20 children and will bury 9 of them before they reach the age of 10. So this is he really has a Job-like life in both the personal tragedies and his many setbacks as a businessman.
One really influential life in John Brown's life was that of his father, Owen. Can you talk about Owen's values and the things that he wanted his children to understand?
Yeah, Owen was a very unusual figure for his day. He was born to the son of a Revolutionary War officer, raised in Connecticut, and then moves John Brown and the rest of the family to Ohio when John Brown's only 5, and really seeks to recreate that New England godly society on what was then the frontier in Ohio. And what made him unusual is, one, he made peace with Indians and worked with them, which was very unusual for whites in that era, and also became a very early abolitionist. Abolitionism is an organized movement, didn't really emerge until the 1830s. Well before then, Owen Brown was harboring fugitive slaves and inculcating his children with a hatred of this institution.
Another key incident in John Brown's childhood was witnessing the abuse of a slave who I gather was about his own age at the time.
Yeah, I think one thing many Americans forget is that slavery for much of our history was not confined to the South. There were still slaves in the North during John Brown's childhood in the early 1800s. And he writes later in his life that, as he puts it, his eternal war on slavery began with seeing a slave boy about his own age when he was about 12 being beaten with a shovel. I don't doubt that that incident happened and had a profound influence on Brown, but I think really his entire upbringing and worldview pushed him towards this crusade against slavery. And I think, as we all do, we try and find single dramatic incidents in our life that explains things, but I'm not sure it was quite that simple.
Right. Can you talk about the kind of education he had, the things that he was good at, the things that he struggled with?
Yeah, he came from really a rather modest background. His father was a farmer and a tanner. He's educated at a log schoolhouse in Ohio, you know, goes to work as a teenager. So he doesn't have a lot of formal education. In some ways, his background wasn't that different from Abraham Lincoln, who's roughly a contemporary. He could recite the Bible by heart. He was obviously a very intelligent man, but not a man with a tremendous amount of book learning, and really self-taught. As the decades passed and he plotted this crusade on slavery, he read very widely about slave rebellions in Haiti and about military tactics from the Napoleonic Wars.
So let's talk about that reading up about military tactics, because it's easy to forget now that the abolitionist movement was subdivided within itself between those who really felt like this had to be something that was abolished peacefully and people who said that that's never going to work.
Right. Most abolitionists followed the lead of William Lloyd Garrison, who was really the pioneer of organized abolitionism in the country. He was a Boston editor who hated slavery and was very heated in his words, but nonviolent indeed. He felt that violence, even in the cause of slave liberation, only really recapitulated the sins of slave drivers, and that the way to end slavery was through education and moral uplift and what they called moral suasion. Brown really diverged from that. He called this milk and water abolitionism, weak and ineffectual. To him, slavery was really a state of war and had to be met in kind.
One thing that's really interesting about Brown, even among abolitionists of his own day, was that in addition to believing slavery was wrong, he fully embraced the idea that African Americans were entirely equal to white Americans, which was not something that was common necessarily even among those who thought slavery was wrong.
Absolutely. Anti-slavery Americans of this day, white Americans who hated slavery, by our lights would be rather white supremacist in their views. Mm. They felt blacks were racially inferior, really incapable of living as equals with whites in America. Abraham Lincoln held this view. He felt freed blacks should be, as they called it, colonized, essentially deported to Africa or Central America. Brown, again, was very different. He really believed in full equality, and he felt it was a moral and practical imperative that whites and blacks fight together to end this institution. Many other abolitionists, it was kind of, leave it to us white folks to take care of this. Really had viewed blacks almost as children. Brown actively courted black support from people like Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, and recruited blacks into his guerrilla army.
And had no trouble living very happily among communities of freed black Americans.
Yep, he one part of his very complicated career, he at one point settled his family among a colony of free blacks in upstate New York. to help them farm. At that point, you needed a certain amount of property to be able to vote in New York. This was a sort of utopian scheme. And Brown lived among blacks. At times, he had blacks living in his home. He would stay for extended periods in the homes of Frederick Douglass and other black supporters. This, again, was very unusual for a white man of that era.
Okay, you say complicated career. Setting aside all the abolitionist activities, this guy was not a great example of how to succeed in business.
No, he was not. And I think this is one of the intriguing things about Brown is that unlike most radicals, he really emerges as a militant abolitionist in his mid-50s, yeah, which was quite an advanced age in that day. He had a very long career before that, and for most of it, he was an American on the make. He was a farmer and a tanner who then got into business and speculated on land. He was trying to get rich, but he repeatedly failed at it. He was an intelligent man, a very hard worker, but he was hopeless at managing money. And at one point, he's declared a bankrupt and really, you know, loses everything he had. He builds himself back up only to sort of overreach and go bust again at about the age of 50. So he really has a very troubled economic life, and his family endures great hardship as a result.
Talk about what it was like to have John Brown as a father.
Well, you know, he has a lot of children, and a number of them write about him. And they describe, you know, how harsh he could be, punishing them very severely for telling, you know, childish fibs. You know, he had a whole set of punishments, how many lashes you would get for lying to mother or not doing your work. So he was certainly a disciplinarian, and like many Americans in that day, you know, didn't spare the rod. But they also wrote of him quite lovingly. He was could also be very tender, and he was particularly tender towards animals. He would bring frozen sheep in and sort of thaw them out in the family tub, and the children wrote about that too. So they had affection towards him, and were clearly fearful of him as well.
And it was important to him not only that they held the same faith he held, but that they also agreed that slavery must be abolished, and in fact that they take an active role in that.
Well, again, it's interesting because actually, with the exception of perhaps one daughter, none of his children adopt his strict Calvinist beliefs. Some of them become quite aggressively anti-Christian in their beliefs. Yet they all share his passionate abolitionism, that he did succeed in inculcating in them. And a number of his children, not just his sons, his daughters, really are involved in his conspiracy and crusade to overthrow slavery.
What kind of communications existed among different factions of the anti-slavery movement in the 1830s up through the 1850s when we're talking about?
You know, abolitionism is a tiny movement, and I think it's another thing Americans often forget today. They were really a small minority who were viewed by the general public often as sort of cranks and scolds. There's nothing really comparable today, but so there were publications that were widely read, like The Liberator. I would say that would be the main forum of for disseminating abolitionist beliefs. They had hundreds of societies, everything from statewide to sort of knitting circles. But John Brown, while in touch with these views, never joined any of these organizations. He was always someone who went his own way and formed his own secret societies.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tony Horwitz is my guest. He's author of the book Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. It's available now in paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tony Horwitz. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of Midnight Rising, John Brown, and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Tony, tell us a little bit about the journey of the territory that was to be Kansas, the state of Kansas, towards statehood in the 1850s.
Yeah. In the mid-1850s, Kansas is really the front line in the struggle over whether slavery will extend to new western territories. And this is really the great conflict of the era. Most northerners, even those who oppose slavery, are willing to let it continue in the states where it exists, but they don't want it to spread. And Kansas is open to new settlement, and the question is left open over whether it will be slave or free. And John Brown arrives there with his sons really in the midst of this conflict and immediately jumps into the fray and through his actions really ignites a much broader and bloodier conflict in Kansas.
Well, tell us about this community of Osawatomie.
Yeah, this is it's a small town now in eastern Kansas. And it was a sort of center of abolitionist resistance, and many New Englanders and others settled there who were very opposed to slavery, and very close by were largely Southerners who had settled as well, who supported slavery. So Osawatomie was sort of the base for Brown and his clan.
So they come in and they essentially try to defend this area and keep slavery even within the Kansas territories from spreading.
Yeah, at this point, initially in Kansas, the South really has the upper hand. They sort of seize control of the mechanisms of this sort of chaotic territorial government. And they're very good at intimidating people at the polls. They come across from nearby Missouri, these groups called border ruffians who would intimidate and sometimes beat up and in some instances kill people who oppose slavery in the territories. And this is what Brown and his supporters are really opposing.
So they sort of made a name for themselves, good in some corners and bad in others there. And then there was a settlement called Pottawatomie, and this is where, for many people, Brown became either infamous or a hero.
Yeah, this is really his coming out as a violent abolitionist. The Southerners, again, are kind of on the charge. They've seized and sacked the town of Lawrence, which was kind of the abolitionist capital in Kansas. And in reply, Brown leads a small group in a night raid on Pottawatomie, which is a pro-slavery settlement. They drag five men from their beds and hack them to death. And as one of Brown's sons put it, the enemy needed shock treatment, death for death. So this was really, ignited the pro-slavery side and helped bring on the conflict that causes us to remember this territory now as Bloody Kansas.
To be clear here, this was a pro-slavery settlement, but the people killed were not slaveholders themselves.
Right. They were very poor, most of them poor settlers from Tennessee who did not own slaves themselves, but had been part of courts and local government that strongly supported the slavery cause. And they were also neighbors of the Browns, and some of the Browns claimed they had been threatened by these people as well. So there may have been an element of sort of personal vendetta involved.
And this whole incident also took a toll on members of Brown's own family.
Yeah, he brings along a number of his sons on this expedition. Some of them are just teenagers, and understandably, they're quite traumatized, or some of them are, traumatized by this not just killing, but in a very intimate, brutal fashion. They weren't shooting people from a distance. They were killing them with broadswords, obviously at close range. And really, a couple of his sons pretty much fall apart after this.
And there was, in fact, a history of mental illness in the family.
Yeah, this is one of the things that constantly gets debated about Brown, and it comes up later at his trial, whether he was insane. And there does seem evidence of a strain in the family. One of his sons was clearly quite disturbed, and a few others very fragile. So this is an element of the family story. I don't think it explains what they did or what he did, but I do think it helps us understand the reactions in some cases.
So where did Brown and his sons go after Pottawatomie?
They really go underground. They become guerrilla fighters, really hiding out in ravines and in woods in Kansas. And then they continue making guerrilla strikes. And at some points, really open field battle. I think it's, again, forgotten that 5 years before the first Battle of Manassas in the Civil War, you have Northerners and Southerners killing each other over slavery in Kansas, sometimes with musket and cannon. This is really, these are really the opening shots of the Civil War.
And this was all very closely followed in the newspapers of the day.
Yeah, newspapers are on the rise in this era. The telegraph is a relatively new invention. And so news is traveling fairly quickly across the country. And newspapers were also, compared to our own day, very one-sided. You know, you had papers that were clearly aligned with the anti-slavery movement or with the pro-slavery movement. So to many in the North, Brown really became a hero. And to those in the South, he was really a villain.
And so those who found him a hero were inclined not only to sort of root for him from afar, at least some people were willing to help fund his activities.
Yeah. Well, there were aid societies formed in New England in particular to send money and guns to help not just Brown, but others involved in the anti-slavery struggle, and Southerners were doing the same. But Brown really uses his Kansas fame to launch this much more ambitious crusade against slavery. And so it's after he emerges from Kansas that he really draws a significant support from ultimately a small group of very wealthy and prominent New Englanders.
The Secret Six.
Yeah, Secret Six. This is a wonderful group because they're totally unlike Brown in most ways. These are six men who are really his core support, funneling him guns and money, ultimately for his famous raid on Harper's Ferry. Two of them are among the wealthiest businessmen of their day. Four of them are Harvard men. These are philosophers, reformers, ministers. Yet they join forces with this sort of rough-hewn frontier warrior, John Brown, to overthrow slavery.
Did they feel entirely that they could sort of trust him? Did they see him as a stable figure? Did they understand him?
I think they understood him, and I don't think trust in the, they certainly didn't feel they could control him. He was a bit of a loose cannon who was happy to take their financial and military aid, but really always followed his own instincts in terms of what he actually did. He was also very secretive, so it was always kind of unclear what it was that he planned. But I think they felt that whatever he did, that he would bring on the great conflict that they felt was necessary to destroy slavery. Many of them really wanted, they couldn't imagine a conflict on the scale of the Civil War, but felt that really the nation had to face this evil and fight over it, and that his actions would help spark that conflict, and that's essentially what happened.
And what Brown really dreamed of was sparking a massive sort of nationwide, the places that slavery existed, slave insurrection.
Yeah, he wanted to take the war against slavery into the South itself, not just oppose its spread in Kansas, not just sort of hope it would slowly die in the way that Abraham Lincoln imagined. He wanted to go in there and by force overthrow this institution. It's not entirely clear how he thought this was going to happen, but he felt that by taking this guerrilla force into Virginia, seizing this enormous federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, freeing and arming slaves, that he would spark a sort of rolling war of liberation across the South.
So he has to muster the forces to do this. He takes not only members of his own family, but he has black and white compatriots. Talk a little bit about the planning process and what they imagined would go down at Harper's Ferry.
Yeah, so this is some years in the making, and it's really a full-blown conspiracy. He's not a lone gunman by any means, and he has, you know, really a broad support, but ultimately he's joined by 21 men and by his daughter and daughter-in-law, who hide out in a mountain farm near Harper's Ferry, gathering their weapons and preparing for this attack on Harper's Ferry. And this, to me, actually is the sort of most suspenseful and human part of the story, because you have these mostly very young men dedicated to this cause, prepared to die for it, yet they've got this months-long period in this hideout to sort of think about it, and they write letters about it. There are love stories. You know, these are young men. They misbehave. They lose faith, and you know they're working the girls hard. You know, so they're writing these letters about we're going to liberate 4 million slaves, and I may die, but I hope to see you again, and so on and so on. And so it's really wonderful to me, just the very human stories of what these men's hopes and dreams were.
And for people who may have forgotten, Harper's Ferry was a federal armory.
Yeah, it's now in West Virginia, and that day it was in Virginia. It's about 60 miles from Washington, D.C., and there were only two federal armories in the whole country, and there were about 100,000 guns there, an enormous number of weapons. And this is also a time when there were, the armed forces of the United States were very small. So this was a scheme and its ambition, not unlike 9/11. It was really a strike against a symbol of American power, intended to really shock the nation, quite aside from seizing these actual guns.
So initially, Brown had thought he needed like 50 men, and he ended up taking, what, was it 21?
Yeah, he has 21 men. The two women leave shortly before the raid. He has 21 men. A few of them stay to sort of guard their supplies, and he leads 18 men ultimately on this night march surprise attack on Harper's Ferry. And unfortunately for Brown, his military skills a bit like his business career. He's a big dreamer. He's charismatic. He's good at getting support, but he's not good at executing his ambitions, either as a businessman or as a military leader.
So what happened? How did they overtake the armory?
Well, they really took Harper's Ferry entirely by surprise. Nobody anticipated. People worried about a slave rebellion like Nat Turner's in 1831 in Virginia, but no one imagined a biracial army sort of sweeping down from the north to attack, the slaveholding South in this way. So initially, they take the town by surprise, seize the armory, seize the bridges into town, and begin freeing slaves from surrounding plantations. So in the early hours of this raid, rather miraculously, Brown really succeeds to a great degree.
And as everyone who knows the story at all realizes, that success ended quickly.
Yeah. I mean, spoiler alert here. the raid ultimately fails, and Brown goes to the gallows with many of his surviving men. He, again, isn't very well organized, and ultimately local whites begin to oppose him and pin him down in Harper's Ferry until Marines, U.S. Marines, under the command of Robert E. Lee and Jeb Stuart, two men who will obviously arise to great prominence in the Civil War, arrive and vanquish this brief uprising.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the way this would have been covered had it happened in the 21st century, because it was a full-scale standoff for a while. I mean, you can imagine sort of the helicopters buzzing around and that sort of thing.
Well, you know, it obviously wasn't like that, but it does happen at an interesting moment in the American media because of the Telegraph and because of the growth of newspapers and wire services. This is one of the first breaking news stories in the country, and because it goes on for a while, not just with the raid itself, but then with the court drama afterwards, you have correspondents swarming to the scene and filing sort of breathless dispatches you know, that are reaching around the country very quickly. So it is, in some senses, a modern media event. And Brown is very good at using the media. He understands that. And he really scares the daylight out of people by making the whole thing seem much bigger than it actually was.
So, Tony, the Harper's Ferry was a federal armory. Why was John Brown put to trial by the state of Virginia rather than the federal government?
Yeah, it's a kind of curious legal story because actually the raid is on a federal armory and it's actually mostly occurs on federal land. It's not even technically part of Virginia. But the Virginians and the governor of Virginia in particular are determined to sort of take responsibility and also credit for jailing and trying and executing this man. They really want a show trial, really, to put abolitionism on trial. And the president, James Buchanan, as students of American history may recall, was one of the weakest executives in our history, mm-hmm. and just basically said, fine, it's a matter of indifference to me. If you want to try him, okay. So they do end up being tried in a civilian court in Charlestown, Virginia, near Harper's Ferry.
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Tony Horowitz. We're talking about his book, Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. The book is available now in paperback. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to be part of it, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Pulitzer Prize winner Tony Horowitz is with us this hour. His book is called Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. It's now available in paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. So, Tony, let's talk about the trial of John Brown. His attorneys felt like they might be able to mount a pretty robust insanity defense. Brown wanted no part of that.
Yeah, Brown does an interesting turnaround, which is he's almost killed in the raid. Most of his men die. And really his military campaign has failed. Yet this man who always talks about action and has contempt for mere talkers and writers really triumphs through the power of his words. And he decides, you know, I've lost this campaign on the ground. I'm going to win it through my courage in going to the gallows. So he doesn't want to get off at this point. And so when his lawyers propose an insanity defense and say we have people willing to attest to his family's history of insanity, he makes it very clear in court. He has no desire that he's not crazy, and that he will not go along with such a defense. So it really doesn't come up again at the trial. So he really is determined to become a martyr at this point, and he does so very successfully.
And he was allowed to speak at some length at his own trial.
Yeah, the court procedures were a bit different from today. He kind of just will interject things at times. It was a rather irregular courtroom scene. On the other hand, he was given a fair trial in the sense that he had lawyers appointed. He was then able to hire his own. There was a jury. All the normal procedures were followed. The problem was that the jury pool, being from that area, was all white male Virginians, most of them slaveholders. So there was never really any question as to the outcome. And Brown also didn't deny most of what he was charged with.
So Brown goes to the gallows. Clearly that solidifies for people in the slaveholding South that he is this horrible person. On the other hand, for abolitionists in the North, even those who were not inclined to violence, his execution made him a martyr.
Yeah, there's this remarkable 5-6 weeks between his capture in Harper's Ferry and his hanging in Virginia. And the combination of his eloquence in court, letters he sends from prison, many of which are published, and then his remarkable unbending courage as he goes to the gallows, really transforms the view of him in the North. Initially, most people are horrified. This is a crazy man. This is not what anti-slavery movement is about. We're not about violence. We're not about attacking slavery in the South. But they're so moved and galvanized by this man that he ends up really being a martyr, almost a Christ figure to many people in the North. And this, of course, horrifies the South all the more. In their view, here is this terrorist and killer, and all these people in the North are applauding him. They're all secret John Browns. This is the sort of paranoia that takes hold in the South, in the white South, and contributes immensely to the drive to mobilize and ultimately secede from the Union.
We have an email here from Tamara who says her dad's family was from North Florida and definitely came down on the gallows side. They would use John Brownit as a substitute swear word.
Yeah, I've heard this, and almost as a sort of John Brown will get you, or I'll be John Brown. It could also just be an exclamation. Mm-hmm. I'll be John Brown, meaning I'm just stunned. But yes, also as a really a swear word, and I think particularly in the South over the generations, he was portrayed as a very villainous figure. And also, his lore has really overshadowed the history itself. Most of us first learn of him from the song,
sure.
John Brown's Body and the Battle Hymn of the Republic. John Brown in art and music and lore really has a very long life beyond what he did in his time.
I was not aware of the relationship between Julia Ward Howe, who wrote The Battle Hymn of the Republic, and John Brown before I read your book.
Yeah, it's another wonderful story. There are so many interesting people who become involved in one way or another. Julia Ward Howe, of course, is a poet, and her husband, Samuel Gridley Howe, is a member of that Secret Six we talked about earlier, that core group of Brown supporters. When the Civil War begins, Massachusetts troops start singing this song about John Brown as they're marching, and Julia Ward Howe hears this, and someone suggests to her, great tune, but gee, you could write better words to it. And she composes the Battle Hymn of the Republic using the same tune that really becomes the anthem of the Union cause. And it doesn't mention John Brown by name, but it's infused with his sort of militant Christianity and his spirit.
So anybody at the time would have made the connection?
Yes, I think so. And clearly it derives from the earlier song, John Brown's Body Lies a-Moldering in the Grave. So the connection was clear.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Joe in Dallas. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I'd like your guest to please comment about the possible public and private relationships between John Brown and elected officials on a local, state, or federal level. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, he was, Brown was certainly followed politics closely. He would write letters to congressmen, particularly in Ohio, which was, you know, kind of his base for most of his life. And so he certainly had contact. Southerners were desperate to find a conspiracy that would reach to much higher. They wanted to implicate people like William Seward, who was a leader of the Republican Party and a prominent anti-slavery spokesman. They never were really able to prove that, and I don't think there were any meaningful ties. I don't think there were politicians who knew what Brown was up to. The worst they could find was a congressman who had given $10 at some fundraiser. And Brown also had contempt for the political system. He felt that really even northern congressmen were simply doing the bidding of slaveholders. So he was actually very anti-government as well. So I don't feel there's any compelling evidence that he had meaningful contact with political figures of the day.
And did that sentiment go both ways? I mean, did they think of him before Pottawatomie as a potentially dangerous figure, or was he just like some crackpot that wrote to them in their minds?
Yeah, he didn't really emerge as a national figure until after his time in Kansas. I think there were some who certainly shared his anti-slavery views and sympathized with him. But yes, I think he was not a figure that politicians would want to get particularly close to. I mean, in the wake of his raid, a number of politicians are then drawn into the story, including Abraham Lincoln, because this happens in the midst or at the beginning of a presidential campaign. So this becomes a national political issue, and you have Abraham Lincoln and Jefferson Davis and many others speaking out about John Brown, but not there wasn't a personal relationship there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Ian in Fort Worth. Hi, Ian.
Oh, hello. I'd like to ask Mr. Horwich if he's ever heard of a book called Flashman and the Angel of the Lord.
Yes, the whole Flashman series by, he's a Scottish writer, right? I think his name is MacDonald, who wrote a series, a wonderful sort of fantasy series about a character named Flashman who, you know, turns up at all these great historic events. So I did read some of it. I didn't read all of it. There was so much history I had to read that I didn't pursue the fictional end except in poetry and parts that relate to John Brown's memory.
At the very beginning of the book, Tony, you note that your son's ninth grade history textbook didn't say much more about Brown than your own said however many years ago. He's a particularly difficult figure to sort of divine down for students, and it's something we struggle with in this country, how much to tell the children about the truth about our history.
Yeah, I think that's one aspect of it. I think there are a few others. I mean, I actually think he is a great teaching tool. I think he's wonderful for the classroom because he's complicated and he raises these very difficult and eternal questions. You know, do the ends ever justify the means? When does an individual have the right to defy their government? You know, who is the final moral arbiter? Is it God? Is it individual conscience? Is it the law? I think one reason he doesn't get a fuller treatment is that he's overshadowed by the Civil War. Mm-hmm. This is a huge event in its day and hugely important in contributing to the Civil War. But then you have this slaughter on such a massive scale and this upheaval that, you know, John Brown's raid on this little town in which, you know, roughly 25 people die in all, you know, comes to seem a skirmish compared to an Antietam or a Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one reason we don't dwell on it as much as we could. And then, as you said, he's almost too hot to handle. I think we're not sure what to do with this figure. He makes us uncomfortable. And I think, we should embrace that ambivalence and explore it and recognize really how American he was. And not just sort of pass judgment on him, all good or all bad. I think he's more complicated than that.
We have an email here from Patrina, who's curious about monuments or recognitions made to John Brown after the Civil War.
Yeah. Again, because of this controversy, I would say there's surprisingly few monuments to John Brown. You won't even find a statue of him in Harper's Ferry. You do find some monuments in Kansas, where ultimately his side won. Kansas entered the Union as a free state, and many Kansans still kind of cherish that history. So you see some monuments to him there and you know, a few other places. But generally speaking, in terms of public or national monuments, you won't find many. It's more in song, in poetry, in art. There's been some wonderful art of Brown. And I would say particularly in the African-American community, he has been an important figure and generally speaking a hero. So you have poems by Langston Hughes, wonderful paintings by Jacob Lawrence and others. So I would say his memory has been strongest in the African-American community.
And Patrina's follow-up question was, what's at Harper's Ferry today? Is it a historic location?
It's wonderful. It's one of my favorite places in America because, one, it's just physically so dramatic. It's essentially a river gorge. It's this town at the base of towering cliffs where the Potomac and Shenandoah rivers meet. So it is a physically fantastic place. And the Park Service has done a wonderful job of preserving the buildings that are there. So it's really a living museum. Not just to John Brown and his raid, there's a lot of other history there too, industrial history. It's Lewis and Clark outfitted their expedition there. This was an important place in the first half of the 19th century. So I strongly recommend anyone who hasn't been there, just put it near the top of your list. You can just have a great time there.
And, you know, we can hear this story and continue to really wrestle with how we feel, particularly about John Brown's methods. But I suppose he was correct in predicting that we would not solve the problem of slavery in this country without bloodshed.
Right. One of his most famous lines was on his way to the gallows, he handed a note to one of his guards, and I won't get the words exactly right, but he says, effectively, I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the sins of this guilty land will never be purged, but with blood. And, you know, 18 months later, the Civil War begins and really confirms his prophecy before the gallows. So I think he, you know, he was a very far-sighted man for all his faults. He forced the country to confront this, not just this evil, but that this need to resolve it. Whether or not bloodshed was the only way, I think, is an interesting historical question, but it certainly played out that way, and in that sense, he was very farsighted.
The latest book by Tony Horwitz is called Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. It's out now in paperback. Tony, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me. Great question.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about Think and download the podcast every day online at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.